Closing argument. Walter Hudson. Pursuing happiness thoughtfully. 8 to 10 weeknights on Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
Let's talk about hypocrisy. It's about time. It's about due that we take a good, strong look at what constitutes political hypocrisy. And in particular, I'm interested in demonstrating over the course of the next 10 minutes or so that hypocrisy on the political front, on the ideological front, is only possible if you're a leftist. It's only possible if you're an authoritarian. There is no such thing as libertarian hypocrisy. No such thing. It's not possible. To the extent that something that you might characterize as libertarian hypocrisy seems to exist, it's indicative of one of two things. Either the person in question is not actually a libertarian, or you have a poor understanding of what it is that they are purporting to be for. We're going to demonstrate that here tonight, starting with an examination of the hypocrisy of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I know you're shocked. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. Getting started a little bit later here on Monday due to your Gophers Hockey Coaches show that goes from about 8 until 8:30 on Mondays during the hockey season. You can join the conversation if you're so inclined. 651-989-5855 is the number to do so. Brian taking those calls and producing the show. Brad still engaged in his duties overseas, hopefully having a good time. I have managed to catch a little bit of that social media action. It looks like they let him off base, which, of course, is fantastic. I saw that he was at Checkpoint Charlie instructing reenactors how to properly salute. So,
of course he was.
We're going to keep that between ourselves. yeah, so, you know, that's Brad is out there making a difference internationally, worldwide. All right, so where to start here? I really am. I've been sitting here thinking about it for half an hour, and I'm still not entirely sure where the best place to start is. Let's start with Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand had a rule of thumb when it comes to determining whether or not a particular idea or premise is moral or immoral. And it bears out, and is particularly apropos to the discussion we're about to have here during this segment. Basically, her rule of thumb was that there is no difference whatsoever between the moral and the practical. What is moral is also practical. What is practical is also moral. If there is a seeming difference between a moral ideal, or what you hold to be a moral ideal, and the practical necessity to act in a certain way, then something is wrong. Something is out of sync, and you need to check your premises. You need to go back to the drawing board and figure out what you have wrong, either the action that you're looking to take or the moral premise that it seems to be in conflict with. And this bears out. You know, when you look at something like environmentalism, which is going to be the source of our consideration here, this segment regarding Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the moral premise that we ought to effectively do away with large swaths of human activity, that we ought to do away with the means of production by which values such as warmth and construction and production are able to take place in order to save the planet. If you hold that to be a moral ideal, then you're going to run up against the question of how practical is that, right? Now, this is a consideration that is nowadays doesn't, when it's proposed in public policy, doesn't even seem to come up. Like the Green New Deal that was proposed by AOC. And now we got another story in here from the Star Tribune. Your own newly elected Governor Tim Walz here in the state of Minnesota is embracing a 100% renewable energy mandate by the year 2050. seemingly there's no consideration whatsoever as to whether or not that's possible, as to whether or not that is even within the realm of possibility. But of course, that's the question we have to ask, right? Like, is it practical? Is it possible? Can you actually do that? And it's very clear once you begin to examine these ideas that it's not practical, that it can't happen, that it isn't possible, which is a good indication, according to Ayn Rand's rule of thumb, that it is not moral. From the Daily Wire, according to the New York Post, Ocasio-Cortez justifies her office's use of carbon-spewing combustion engine vehicles and frequent air travel by noting that she is just, quote, living in the world. Representative Cortez has responded to reports that despite being the author of the extreme environmental legislation known as the Green New Deal, she has a far larger carbon footprint than the average American and does not appear to have made any changes to her lifestyle despite her apocalyptic environmental predictions. Now, it's interesting here that her response to this is to say, look, I live in the world. She said, I also fly and use air conditioning in a tweet on Saturday. She said, living in the world as it is, isn't an argument against working towards a better future. Now, I find this fascinating because she's right. Like, on its face, just those words, living in the world as it is, isn't an argument against working towards a better future. That is absolutely correct. But she doesn't get to make that argument. As an authoritarian, as a leftist, as somebody who's advocating for the initiation of force to keep you and I from acting upon our own judgment in pursuit of our values, in pursuit of our happiness, she doesn't get to make the argument that living in the world as it is isn't an argument against making the world a better place. You know who does get to make that argument? Libertarians. People who are for freedom. Let me talk about something or disclose something personal that at face value may be characterized as an example of hypocrisy on my part. You know, I had a show, I believe it was last Wednesday or Thursday, spent the vast majority of the show here on Closing Argument railing against public education as an institution. And within the context of that show, I talked about the fact that I send my kid to public school. I was talking about the fact that the next day, it was Wednesday, because I remember this rant, that the next day, Thursday morning, I was going to get up and I was going to send my kid off to this vile institution that is not doing what it was formulated, conceived in order to accomplish. And that we collectively, by supporting this institution, are part of the problem. Now, am I a hypocrite because I send my kid to public school? And look, not only do I send him to public school, I send him to public school on public roads. I send them to public school on a bus paid for by public dollars, right? And then I get on those same public roads in order to engage in my occupation, in order to make money, in order to provide for my family, right? So is that an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez level episode of hypocrisy when compared to something like her using Uber and flying on airplanes and using air conditioning and whatnot in light of proposing the Green New Deal? No, it is not. These are night and day. One is hypocrisy, the other is not. And you know why? Because when she says living in the world as it is isn't an argument against working towards a better future, I actually am living in the world as it is. I'm living in a world where I don't get to control whether or not public education is a thing. I don't get to control whether or not the infrastructure is funded through public dollars. I don't get to control the extent to which authoritarians utilizing the club of the state have intervened in the market and in doing so have displaced market solutions to problems and have left many of us in a scenario whereby the highest value at the lowest cost for us is a public option, not because it's the best option, because it's the only option that has been developed in the context that's been left. And let me give you paint a picture for you to kind of make this a little bit more clear. Imagine, if you will, that you are a prisoner. You've been captured, you've been imprisoned wrongfully. You know, we'll just assume that you're not actually a criminal in this case. some authoritarian regime has captured you and put you in prison. Three times a day, because they're not completely inhumane, they offer you a meal. Now, you have the choice whether you're going to eat the food or not. Are you going to starve, or are you going to eat the prison food that is provided for you? Now, if you choose to eat the food that's provided for you, are you therefore granting moral sanction to your captors? Are you saying that by taking this food, by making this choice in the context that I find myself, to eat this food, are you therefore saying it is right and proper for me to be imprisoned? Of course not. Of course not. You're doing exactly what AOC says here. You're living in the world as it is, despite the fact that you'd like to see a change. If it was up to you, it would be different. If it was up to you, you wouldn't be imprisoned. If it was up to you, you wouldn't have to eat the prison food. But it's not up to you, because you have been captured. You are under force. You are under authority. And that's the situation that we all find ourselves in when we make choices like sending our kids to public school, or driving on public roads, or paying our taxes. Right? To the extent that we work within the environment that has been crafted for us by the state, we are doing what we have to in order to get by in the world as it is, as AOC says. But she doesn't get to make that argument. Because indeed, the only way that moral math works, that hypocrisy model works, is if you're the one who's advocating for freedom, right? Like, you know, you don't get to argue, well, you know, we don't live in a world where people are forced not to fly in airplanes. Therefore, I'm going to make the choice to fly in an airplane, even though I'm telling you that it's destroying the world. Well, no. Like, if you legitimately believe that the world is coming to an end, that the planet is doomed, that we're going to be, as she said, that like civilization is going to come to an end within 12 years if we don't stop using carbon fuels and reducing our carbon footprint, then the obligation is upon you as an individual to take action that is consistent with that premise today, right now. And you don't have to wait for somebody to put a gun to your head. In fact, nobody should have to put a gun to your head. If you really believe it, then it should come naturally that you abstain from air travel, that you abstain from using vehicles, from using carbon emissions and what have you, air conditioning, and all these modern conveniences. But it doesn't for her. That makes her a hypocrite. Now, in my view, and in the view of, or in the instance of my life and the lives of libertarians everywhere, we make decisions in the context that we find ourselves because that context is outside of our control. Her context is not outside of her control. She has it completely within herself to abstain from activities that she would use the force of government to keep other people from taking, right? But she doesn't believe in that. She, what it comes down to is she doesn't want to take the action herself. She wants to force other people to take the action, which is the opposite of the libertarian perspective, which is I'm never going to force somebody to put their kid in a private school. I'm never going to force somebody to take any sort of action whatsoever. I just want to have the option to do it, absent the initiation of force from someone outside, particularly from the state. That's the difference. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130, 103.5 FM. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
5 FM.
Still don't know what I was waiting for. Even her fellow leftists are calling out Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on her hypocrisy when it comes to her personal behavior and her lifestyle, which is out of sync with her prescribed limitations on human activity, fitting with her Green New Deal and her view on environmentalism. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us this evening. Also from the Daily Wire, Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, slammed Socialist Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on Saturday for being a hypocrite over living a lifestyle that does not align with her extremist views on climate change. Moore, who has a PhD in ecology, called out Ocasio-Cortez after she mocked a New York Post article that highlighted her numerous flights and car travel, which are things she attacked in her Green New Deal. I also fly and use air conditioning. Living in the world as it is isn't an argument against working towards a better future, Ocasio-Cortez tweeted. The Green New Deal is about putting a lot of people to work in developing new technologies, building new infrastructure, and getting us to 100% renewable energy. That was her response. Moore fired back, "The world as it is has the option of taking the subway rather than a taxi. Option of Amtrak rather than plane. Option of opening windows rather than air conditioning. You're just a garden variety hypocrite like the others, and you have zero expertise at any of the things you pretend to know." And this is somebody on her side. this is the co-founder of Greenpeace. All right.
They're eating their own and they're hungry for more.
This was hardly Moore's first time going after Ocasio-Cortez on Twitter. "Yep, if you don't like the Green New Deal, then come up with your own ambitious on-scale proposal to address the global climate crisis," Ocasio-Cortez had tweeted on February 26th or 22nd. "Until then, we're in charge, and you're just scouting from the cheap seats." Moore responded to that, saying, "Pompous little twit, you don't have a plan to grow food for 8 billion people without fossil fuels or get the food into the cities. Horses? If fossil fuels were banned, every tree in the world would be cut down for fuel. For cooking and heating, you would bring about mass death." This guy sounds like more of a conservative than...
He's actually switched his position in recent years or in the past 10 or so. It's known, I guess.
Gotcha. So there you go. And look, I mean, and that goes to the point of what we're talking about in our first segment here tonight, which is that, yes, indeed, here's how you know that somebody's being a hypocrite. Okay, let's a workable definition of hypocrisy, because I think that there is very commonly applied in the public discourse a definition of hypocrisy that isn't accurate. And that's the idea that the kind of simplified notion of saying one thing and doing another. You say you're for private education, but you send your kid to public school, so you're a hypocrite. Well, no, that is not hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is claiming to believe one thing, but then it's very evident that you don't actually believe it. So if you're Al Gore and you claim that the sea levels are rising and the earth is doomed, and if we don't do something to curb greenhouse gas emissions, then within the next 10 years, San Francisco is going to be underwater, and your beachfront property in San Francisco remains on the books and you're living there, that's very clear that you don't actually believe what you're saying. Because if you did believe it, you would sell your house. If you did believe it, you would take certain actions that are consistent with what you're saying. That's the marks of hypocrisy. And that is exclusive to the left. And it's something that's evident throughout socialists and socialism historically. The socialists in charge have always lived, despite the fact that they've railed against the bourgeoisie and railed against capitalism and railed against income inequality and what have you. When socialists take power, they always, always live large. They live like kings while their people starve every single time. Hypocrisy is baked into the cake of socialism. And, you know, they probably rationalize it in their own heads, much in a similar fashion to what AOC is doing here in terms of saying, well, it's the world in which we live. And there's probably this moral calculation that they rationalize in their own heads of, well, I'm doing so much good for the world that I deserve this. I'm doing so much good for the world by putting forward the Green New Deal that I've earned my air conditioning for the day. I've earned my flight. And plus, how else am I going to win this election, right? How else am I going to engage in this campaign against the capitalists, against the bourgeois, if I don't have access to these resources in order to spread my message? And again, it reveals that tension between a prescribed moral premise, a prescribed moral principle, and the practical reality of what it takes to actually accomplish whatever it is you're trying to accomplish. That's a strong red flag that your moral premise is flawed. that your premises need to be checked. Your principle needs to be reevaluated. If it doesn't work in the real world, if you can't implement it without contradicting yourself, then you're probably wrong. Pretty decent bet. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, 651-989-5855, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. How should we think about the founders? How should we regard the founding generation, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence? These are questions that I think conservatives in particular need to spend a little bit of time considering, because I think the answers that we immediately and instinctively go to are not always the most productive. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We're here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate having you with us. You can join the conversation, 651-989-5855. Brianne taking those calls and producing the show for us. So, you know, we talked about public education a little bit as an example in the last hour, and I did a show last week where we expounded extensively on the problems with the public education system and the moral premises and the moral failings of that institution. And I posted some segment of that program to our Facebook page, which, by the way, you can check out, Closing Argument with Walter Hudson. Do a search. Give us a like. Set yourself to be notified when we post things. And I had a lefty who follows us and who comments on our posts from time to time make a comment to the effect of, well, you know, the founding fathers were all for public education, which is true, right? Like Thomas Jefferson in particular played a role. He founded the University of Virginia, which was a public university. And there was a sentiment in the founding generation that public education is something that ought to be strived for, that it was a good thing for the populace at large to be educated, and that a public education system was a good means for producing that, an educated populace. And so, you know, this is presented as, and I found it amusing in one sense, because, you know, here's one of the rare cases, and you see this every once in a while, one of the rare cases where somebody on the left is citing something that the founding fathers said or did as a rationale for their position or as an argument against something that a conservative says. This happens every once in a while. And it's always fascinating because it's kind of like when they quote the Bible, right? Like they're always citing the one thing they agree with, even though we know that they throw out the entire context. Like they throw out everything else around it and the core premise upon which it's all rooted in. That's all garbage. But we're going to take this one quote or this one aspect of what the founders were trying to accomplish, or what the founders said, or what they were for, and act as though that's gospel, right? And it raises this question of, how should we think about the founding generation? How should we think about the founding fathers? Did they have it all figured out? Just to cut to the chase, I think the answer is obviously no, obviously. And you know who the first people would be to admit that they didn't all have it figured out? The founding fathers. Like, those guys would be the first ones to say, yeah, we don't know. Right? I mean, in essence, what is the amendment process to the Constitution of the United States, if not providing posterity with the capacity to correct oversight, right? To say, look, you know, situations may develop in the future whereby it's determined that this document as presented, as ratified, is inadequate for the governance of this federal entity that we've created. So here's your process, your amendment process, whether it's a convention of the states or an act of Congress or whatever the process is that we're going to utilize in order to attempt to amend it. Here's your means by which you can change this document. Now, obviously, I mean, you know, that's a pretty strong indication that we're not dealing with scripture, right? That we're not dealing with something that is the same yesterday, today, and forever. when you have an amendment process, implicit in that is that this is potentially incomplete. This potentially might need to be changed. This might need to be looked at some other time. And I think that the existence of the amendment process in the Constitution stands as a mark post or a signpost, as it were, for us to begin to think correctly about the Founding Fathers and about the Constitution and about the Declaration of Independence, and realize that while these things, while this generation and these documents deserve their place of reverence in our history and are undervalued and under-revered by the modern generation, they are nonetheless fallible. Fallible. They got after something extremely important: individual rights, liberty, the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, inalienable rights, God-given rights. They got after something incredibly essential, but they didn't get all the way there. I mean, after all, and this is, you know, again, this is why I giggle a little bit when a leftist cites the Founding Fathers as part of their argument, is these are the same people who will be the first to tell us, yeah, but slavery, right? Like, that's their argument anytime you bring up anything constitutional or anything having to do with the founding generation. Yeah, but slavery, right? So there was slavery in the United States of America for a long period of time. We had to fight a civil war in order to end it. Therefore, that completely invalidates basically everything that the founding generation did, right? Because we can't take anything that they said and afford it any sort of merit, because these are the same men who went home to their homesteads and their plantations and held slaves. Well, obviously, that's not true, right? Like, you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. At the same time, you also can't ignore it. It's true. Slavery was a thing. Slavery is something we have to contend with as a part of our history. And we have to reconcile. We have to consider how it was that this question of, should all men be treated equally? Should all human beings be treated equally? That was a question that had to be worked out and dealt with over several years, several decades during the course of our nation's existence. And so, you know, I think the proper way to regard the hazard that I see, and I saw this as part of the Tea Party movement in those early years, 2008, 2009, in reaction to Obama, we were turning back to the founding generation. We were turning back to the Constitution. We were turning back to the Declaration. There was an almost godlike reverence that was granted to these founding documents and to the founding fathers. And it was treated like scripture. It was treated like gospel. And it's understandable why people would err in that direction, particularly during the dawn of Obama and his desire to fundamentally transform the United States of America. But it is an error. It is erring in a different direction. The proper way to view these things is as achievements, noteworthy human achievements, worthy of reverence, but fallible nonetheless. Getting after something important, but doing so in imperfect and incomplete fashion. We have yet to see the manifestation of a human society, a human civilization, a human government that truly, fully, completely recognizes, enshrines, and respects individual rights. We haven't gotten there yet. And recognizing that we haven't gotten there yet, that at no point in history have we ever gotten there, is a prerequisite to actually getting there. So this is important. From Slate: does the First Amendment bar public officials from blocking people on social media because of their viewpoint? That question has hung over the White House ever since Donald Trump assumed the presidency and continued to block users on Twitter. The Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University has sued the president on behalf of blocked users, spurring a lively academic debate on the topic. But Trump isn't the only politician who has blocked people on social media. This week, a federal court weighed in on the question in a case with obvious parallels to Trump's. It determined that the First Amendment's free speech clause does indeed prohibit office holders from blocking social media users on the basis of their views. Davison versus Loudoun County Board of Supervisors involved the chair of the Loudoun County Board of Supervisors, Phyllis Randall. In her capacity as a government official, Randall runs a Facebook page to keep in touch with her constituents. In one post to the page, Randall wrote, "I really want to hear from any Loudoun citizen on any issues, request, criticism, compliment, or just your thoughts." She explicitly encouraged Loudoun residents to reach out to her through her county Facebook page. Brian C. Davidson, a Loudoun denizen, took Randall up on her offer and posted a comment to the post on her page alleging corruption on the part of the Loudoun County School Board. Randall, who said she had no idea whether Davidson's allegations were true, deleted the entire post, thereby erasing his comment, and blocked him. The next morning, she decided to unblock him. During the intervening 12 hours, Davidson could view or share content on Randall's page, but couldn't comment on its posts or send it private messages. Davidson sued, alleging a violation of his free speech rights. A U.S. District Judge James C. Chicharis explained in his decision, Randall essentially conceded in court that she had blocked Davidson because she was offended by his criticism of her colleagues in the county government. In other words, she engaged in viewpoint discrimination, which is generally prohibited under the First Amendment, Kacharis elaborated. And then it goes on to make his legal claim. Now, here's the problem with this, as I see it. And this is not the first time we've discussed this. We've discussed this concept of the First Amendment entitling people to engage with elected officials on social media and to tweet them and retweet them and to comment on their posts and what have you. Viewpoint discrimination, of course, is a violation of the First Amendment, but in what context, right? Like it's a violation of the First Amendment in a context where you have the implicit inherent right to a particular platform. So for instance, if you had a space that was available for rent or for reservation, like at the public library or in City Hall or whatever the case may be, at a park somewhere in your community, and any group was entitled to utilize that space to rent it out or to reserve it and use it for a rally or for a meeting or to engage in some sort of expression of speech, and they were denied on the basis of their viewpoint, that obviously would be viewpoint discrimination and a violation of the First Amendment. But that's not what we're talking about here. There is no implicit right to comment on a tweet. There is no implicit right to be on somebody's Facebook page. Now, if you want to make the case that this gal is hypocritical, that she went back on her espoused premise, you know, because she put forward this post saying, hey, I'm interested in any sort of, and apparently she capitalized the word any Loudoun citizen commenting on any issue, including criticism or just your thoughts, right? Like she put that out there and then she turns around and deletes this guy's comment and bans him from the page. You want to argue that she's a hypocrite? Go ahead. You want to call her out on being inconsistent? That's fine. You're free to make that case. But you can't argue that she violated his First Amendment rights. You know why? Because he, at no point was he denied the capacity to say whatever he wants. At no point was he denied a platform to which he had an implicit right. And this idea that you get to commandeer the stage, because that's the thing, is when we consider these rights applied to digital forums or digital venues, it's helpful to think of the venues in physical terms. So you would never argue, well, some people would, but they'd be wrong, that you should be able to come into a city council meeting, for instance, and you should be able to just trounce on up to the stage and push everybody else aside, grab the microphone, and just take over the agenda and it become all about you. Like you would never get away with that. And you could not defend that conduct on the basis of the First Amendment because you don't have an implicit right to take over that platform and use it for your own speech. Now, you could say whatever you want on your Facebook page, your Twitter, a space that you reserve or that you rent out, a newspaper, a letter to the editor, whatever means you have at your disposal to say what you want to say, that speech is protected. but you don't get to seize other people's venues. And that's what this social media engagement is. When people comment on or retweet or post things tagging Donald Trump, what they're really trying to do is they're trying to take his platform and they're trying to leverage it in order to get their message out. Well, people don't follow it. They wouldn't need to do that if people were following them to and wanted to hear what they had to say. People are following Donald Trump and want to hear what he has to say. And that's why they're tagging him, in order to siphon off the attention that he gets and redirect it to them. That is not a First Amendment issue. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk. Doc.
5 FM.
I'm glad that we've been able to have this regular segment on Wednesdays where we have either Jacob Brunton or Cody Leibolt, the partners in crime over at ChristianIntellectual.com, to come on and talk with us about issues having to do with the intersection between Christianity and politics, and in particular, the need for an intellectual reformation within Christianity. Because it seems as though, you know, we talk often on this program about the trajectory of the culture, and the sense in which it seems that the table, the deck is stacked and the table is tilted in the direction of the left, in the direction of socialism. And it seems as though the compromises are always being made in that direction. The reforms and the great leaps forward in public policy and reformation and revolution are always taking a leftist bent and a leftward trajectory. And why is that? Why is it that conservatives are losing? Why is it that the culture is moving more and more in the direction of leftist ideology and leftist thought? And, you know, the answer, the short version of the answer is, it's because conservatives are dropping the ball. And within the scope of conservatives, we have to look at Christians and evangelicalism and the Christian community, the church. The church is dropping the ball. It used to be, you know, we speak in the founding generation, and we talked last segment about how we ought to revere the founders, or how we ought to think about the founders. One thing that needs to be recognized about the founding generation is the prominent role that both the clergy and the laymen attending congregations during the founding generation, the role that Christianity played in the American Revolution in providing the moral premises and the moral backbone for the actions and the movement that took place to win liberty, to win freedom, to win independence from the British Empire. And, you know, that type of conviction, that type of taking a stand, putting a stake in the ground and saying this far, no further. And indeed, you know, let's advance in a different direction, in a more libertarian, more hopeful direction, and free men from their chains. That's something that, yeah, you know, it didn't happen spontaneously. It didn't happen out of the blue. It was thoughtful. It was intentional. It was something that came from, in large part, came from the pulpit, came from churches. Boy, how things have changed. Now it seems that, you know, you look to Christian leaders, especially the more prominent they are, the more of a household name they are, the more likely it is that they're preaching something that, if is not explicitly leftist, it opens the door towards the further advancement of quote-unquote social justice. By way of example, from the Christian Post, Pastor Tim Keller has warned against making blue state or red state individualism for true Christianity in a post-Christian culture that it has co-opted biblical ideas and taken them to an extreme. In a recent video posted on the Gospel Coalition website, Keller, senior pastor at Redeemer Presbyterian Church, said that in today's post-Christian Western society, it's very difficult for Christians to engage culture without becoming colonized by it. Even just that language, right? Like, who talks about being colonized? That's a leftist term. The reason for that is, this is Keller explaining, the reason for that is a post-Christian culture is quite different than a non-Christian or pre-Christian culture, he explained, adding that the post-Christian culture has co-opted a lot of Christians' ideas and taken them to the extreme. Keller argued that biblical principles, like the importance of doing right and justice, for example, have been turned into extreme individualism by Western culture. Unfortunately, he said, it's easy for Christians to get co-opted by that individualism. Liberal individualism, Keller asserted, says, I need to do justice for the poor and I need to do racial justice, but nobody should tell me what to do sexually. On the other hand, conservative individualism says, I believe in traditional values, but I can do anything I want with my money, and please don't talk to me about race because I didn't own any slaves and I don't think that's a problem. It's extraordinarily easy for Christians to think that they are being Christian, but they are actually getting co-opted by either what I would call blue state or red state individualism, Keller continued. That's not just as likely to happen if you're a Christian who grew up in India. You're not likely to just sort of fall into Hinduism. You're not as likely if you're a Christian growing up in Japan to just fall into Buddhism, but you are very likely to fall into one of these forms of liberal or conservative individualism thinking it's Christianity. Now, of course, the curious thing here is the word individualism and the idea that there are, first of all, that there's such a thing as liberal individualism, socialist individualism, what an oxymoron that is. But then the notion that individualism as such is something that, one, ought to be avoided, and two, is somehow antithetical to Christianity. Let me be as clear about this from a theological perspective as I possibly can. Christianity doesn't exist in any context other than individualism. At no point in the history of Christianity has a group of people been saved. It doesn't work that way, right? Like, you, as a parent, I can't save my child or bring my child to salvation. And as a child, I can't rely upon my parents or my pastor or somebody else to do that lifting for me. Salvation is an individual process, theologically speaking, from every Christian perspective across the board. There's no such thing as collective salvation. And so the idea that we ought to avoid individualism, Keller and, you know, similar people who advance similar ideas need to explain, need to account for in their theology how that jives with their gospel message or their gospel interpretation, if they even bother to consider that in the first place. And I think that might be the problem, is that for a lot of these people, their Christian identity is really just branding for the advancement of the thing that they find more important, which is social justice, the political cause. That's really what they're about. They're about marketing. They're about the campaign to affect society. They're not about actually advancing any sort of genuinely theologically Christian idea. And, you know, for, first and foremost, for those of us, if you find yourself in the camp of identifying as both conservative and a Christian, the first task before us is to clean up this nonsense in the church, if we have any hope of reviving that engine of American revolution that fueled the founding generation. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
5FM.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. You can contribute to the show, 651-989-5855. Brianne taking those calls, producing the show for us. Let's chat with Nancy in Apple Valley. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. As a Christian, this is really near and dear to my heart. I struggle with this a lot, a conservative. But what I was wondering is if you could clarify just a little bit one of your last comments before the break. You had said, first and foremost, we need to kind of clean up this nonsense, I'm paraphrasing, within the Christian church. And I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. Do you mean the leap towards collective salvation and social justice? Or could you clarify that for me, I guess?
Yeah, I guess it seems as though for an increasing number of institutions and celebrity style personalities within the Christian community, their mission statement, perhaps they have an explicit mission statement or perhaps it's just implicit, but the mission statement has very little to do with the actual biblical gospel of sin, God's position versus man's position, the need for reconciliation, the process through Christ and the atonement to actually reconcile humanity with God. That core gospel message seems to be secondary, if present at all, to what is put front and center, which is the need for social justice, a social gospel, a desire to change the world, to make the world a better place by healing inequities and healing disparities and putting us all on even footing.
Yeah, I totally agree. The church is being led by the culture, and that is scary to me. I belong to a church that recently changed its mission statement to, sharing the hope and heart of Jesus Christ to loving like Jesus. And that concerns me.
Right.
And I see that I left the church 10 years ago because of that leap from the ECLA or ELCA.
Yeah.
And so I'm very with you. I just don't know what we can do other than make clear to our pastors how we feel about it. And as a new generation, younger generation of pastors come in, I think the lines are really blurred with them.
Well, look, as I'm sure you're aware, the you talk about a younger generation of pastors. Part of the problem is the same sort of institutional takeover that has occurred in public education and in the corporate institutions and, in government institutions has also manifested in the seminaries. Mm-hmm. Like these pastors are coming out of seminaries that are teaching them that they ought to be focused on social justice, and they ought to be focused on equity, and they ought to be focused on, quote, loving the way that Jesus loved, which, of course, they use that language as a kind of a cloak to mask what it is that they're really getting after. But, of course, they're not actually loving the way Jesus loved. You know how Jesus loves? Jesus loves by going into the temple with a cord of whips. And, turning over the tables and running the money changers out of the temple, right? Like, that's his love. Jesus loves by calling people hypocrites and poisonous vipers and calling them on their nonsense on a regular basis.
And by saying, you're forgiven.
Right.
Go and sin no more.
Right.
Right.
Two people who have accepted that. It's not unconditional. It's never been unconditional. If it was unconditional, he wouldn't have had to die, right? I mean, that's the and I appreciate the call as always, Nancy. The thing that really strikes me from a Christian perspective is so absurd about this notion that it's all about love, unconditional love, and the concept of equity and treating everybody fairly and whatever. That's the focus. If that were true, then why did he die? Why the cross? What was the point of the cross if all we need to do is just love each other? If that's all we need to do, why didn't he just come here and love everybody? Why did he have to die? Why did he have to be tortured? Obviously, there was something else at stake. Obviously, there was some greater dynamic in play, something extremely important to justify going through that. And, I shouldn't be the one who has to make this case and make this argument and in defiance of the winds of Christian institutions, the seminaries, the organizations, the denominations, the groups that are organizing and holding conferences and what have you, and engaging in the political discourse. This should be 101. This should be the first thing out of the mouths of anybody who calls himself a pastor. Now, I'm fortunate enough to attend a church where that's the case. And, you know, those are apparently fewer and farther between each other. But that as Nancy put forward, that's the first thing we need to do is make sure that it's very clear amongst those who have been tasked with shepherding us that what our expectation is, that their first and foremost mission and responsibility is to focus on that gospel message and not to creep into the direction of the social gospel or the social justice warrior nonsense, because that has nothing, one has nothing whatsoever to do with the other. All right, let's look ahead to 2020. The Democrats are just a hot mess. So there's a piece here at the Daily Wire. Former President Bill Clinton has a lot of advice to give about running for president, but not a single serious 2020 Democratic candidate seems to want to hear it. The Associated Press reports that Clinton has marketed himself to 2020 contenders and made himself available for long chats about the ins and outs of presidential politics, but so far, only a handful of potential candidates and none of the frontrunners have taken advantage of Clinton's office hours. Now, it seems clear that the reason why here is, you know, why do we want to hear from a old, white, heterosexual male, right? That's not the demographic that the Democrats are going after in 2020. And that's not the type of candidate that they're interested in hearing from. They're not interested in how to win in 1999 or 1994, right? They're interested in how to win in 2020, and in their view, the way to do that is going to be to go as extreme left as humanly possible. From Politico, is Beto O'Rourke the progressive icon who, during his Senate run against Ted Cruz, talked about legalizing marijuana and impeaching Donald Trump? Or is he the centrist Texan who, during his first run for the House, raised the possibility of making Social Security less generous for future retirees? It might be the biggest question lingering over O'Rourke as he prepares for a likely run for the Democratic presidential nomination. Just what does he believe, actually? Now, the fascinating thing about this article, because the idea here is, you know, as we look ahead to the primary contest and to the Democrats trying to select who their person is going to be to run against Donald Trump, this question of what do these people actually believe and are they actually progressive enough? Are they actually sold out to and bought into the social justice cause? In this piece, they describe O'Rourke's position on entitlements like Social Security. This guy is to the right of Paul Ryan. I mean, if this article is to be believed, he actually wants to make adjustments to benefits to the downside in order to make Social Security sustainable. Which is probably, potentially, if he holds to that, going to kill his chances of being the Democratic nominee in 2020. But lordy lord, like, why can't we get this from a Republican? We got to turn to Beto O'Rourke to find somebody talking seriously and sustainably about what we're going to do about entitlements? Apparently. And another piece in Politico talks about Joe Biden and the potential of him getting in on this. Now, Biden is personally the potential candidate who I fear the most. Now, I don't think the Democrats are going to nominate him for all the reasons that they're not interested in hearing from Bill Clinton. Because, you know, being a older, white, heterosexual male is out of vogue within the Democratic Party nowadays. But if they actually got their act together and decided to be sane and try to play to the broader general electorate, Biden would be a fantastic choice because he's somebody who can speak the language of normal people in spite of being associated with highly abnormal causes and ideology. 651-989-5855. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
FM.
You know, in Christian circles, we often talk about being Christ-like. And nowadays, most often, it seems when people advocate for being Christ-like, what they really mean is to try to model himself off of a caricature of Christ, a cartoon character version of Jesus that's all happy and soft-spoken and caring and, you know, wrings his hands and gives hugs, right? Like this, that's what being Christ-like is like in their view. But, you know, when you actually, you know, read the book, when you actually read the Gospels, Christ, if there's one thing you can say about him, about the way he engaged with people, you could say that it seemed like he never really cared whether or not people A, agreed with him, or B, even understood what he was saying. He left people dumbfounded in his wake all the time. The most common reaction to Jesus Christ talking was people being dumbfounded and wanting to kill him. Those were the two reactions that he got from people. So when we, as Christians within the Christian community, when we talk about being Christ-like, I guess one question we could rightfully ask ourselves is, are people confused by us, and do they want to kill us? Because, you know, not to say that it's a direct correlation, that has to be the response that people have when they talk to you, but there ought to be some kind of correlation, right? Like, if we are actually trying to model ourselves off of God incarnate, then we need to look at how he actually engaged with people and what the reaction of the world, what the reaction of the culture was to that engagement. And I'll tell you this, it was not the type of social justice crusade that's coming out of modern seminaries. 651-989-5855, closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Let's talk to Carl in Roseville. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Walter. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
You were talking about church, and I remember about 5 years ago that a church that I went to, the sermon was on recycling and how good that was, right, that we needed to save the planet.
Right.
And I sent an email back and forth with the minister a couple of times, and they don't care.
Yeah. Well, you mean there was no response, or he...
Oh, no, there was a response, but the response was just in justifying why it was a good and proper sermon.
Right. Yeah, I appreciate the call, Carl. Yeah, I don't understand. You know, I went to, I'm not going to give the name of the church, but I went to a church for a period of time here in the Twin Cities that my wife and I, we made the decision we had to leave it. Because they were giving, it was those types of messages. It was this kind of can't, the best way to characterize it was like Oprah on Sunday morning, which I don't watch Oprah ever on any other morning or day or afternoon or night. So why do I want to get up and give up one of my days off, get up on a Sunday to go hear some pastor give his best impression of Oprah by talking about, you know, felt needs and political issues and you know, recycling or whatever the case may be. That's not compelling. That's not interesting. That's not provocative. And it's not an answer to any actual problem that I have. I don't need to hear that. What I need to hear is how sin is a problem and what the solution to sin is and how reconciling myself to God is going to solve my problems, not just in the here and now, but in eternity. That's worth getting up on a Sunday to go hear. A little bit of fire and brimstone is what I'm looking for. And fortunately, I found a place where I was able to get some of that. Let's talk to Nate in Woodbury. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Walter. How you doing?
Good.
So, as I've done in the past many times, I kind of want to get a little bit of an agnostic perspective on this. And
sure.
Also, you know, have some knowledge as I say, a recovering Catholic, but you know, of course, my understanding of doctrine when I was growing up was it was always supposed to be love the sinner, hate the sin.
Uh-huh.
And I think that perhaps where a lot of this goes wrong is that there is this thought process in people's minds, both from a religious perspective or a non-religious perspective, that's like, well, because we want to help others, we want to do good things for other people, well, that means that, you know, we should legislate it. Well, the problem is that charity through, you know, the force of the barrel of a gun is no virtue.
Right.
And it's the entire concept of, you know, we're going to force other people to do good or behave a certain way towards other people or to give to other people through taxation or whatever. That's there is nothing about that that is virtuous from either a religious perspective or a personal perspective. No different than in salvation and Christianity.
Appreciate the call, Nate. We're out of time for tonight, but we'll give you the last word. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.